भवति भारत। अध्युत्थानम् अधर्मशम् तदात्मानम् सृजाम्यहम्। परित्राणाय साधुना विनाशाय च दुष्कृता। धर्म संस्थापनार्थाय शम्भवामि युगे युगे, शम्भवामि युगे युगे। हरेर्नाम हरेर्नाम हरेर्नामै केवलम्। नास्तेव 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 गतिरं तथा।
हरे कृष्ण, गुड मॉर्निंग एंड वेलकम टू आवर वीकली कृष्ण कॉन्शियस रेडियो शो। Wishing you a very happy and prosperous day. We invite you all to visit the Hare Krishna Temple, which is at 1229 Coatesville Revived Highway, also known as Highway 28. The prayers there in the temple starts every morning from 4:30 with Mangal Aarti. Then there is Lord's Singar Aarti at 7 o'clock, and the darshan is closed from 1 to 4 p.m. after the midday Bhoga Aarti. The darshan then reopens at 4 p.m. followed by Sandhya Aarti at 7, and the temple closes for the day with the evening Aarti at 9 p.m. Every Sunday there is a special public program called Sunday Love Feast, which starts with Kirt at 12 o'clock. The midday Aarti of their lordships is held at 12:30, and from 1 o'clock there is a discourse based on Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, after which we practice Japa meditation for a while, followed by Guru Puja of our founder Acharya, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, and the program ends with a love feast at 2:30. All of you, along with your family and friends, please come along and visit their lordship Sri Radha Giridhari, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra and Gauri Nitai, and get their blessings by listening to their holy teachings and honoring Mahaprasad, and get yourself and your friends blessed.
In a world full of tests and chemistry and science, and if we have, religion has gone on for thousands of years, and if you look at the Hindu literatures, it says millions of years. Why is there still the question of not scientifically proving God? Do we really need religion in a world that is full of science, and we can actually prove that the scientific experiments? But religionists for thousands of years have tried to inculcate faith in people, but have invariably failed, or something has happened. So do we need religion in a world of science?
Yeah, thank you so much. We're living in a world today where an aggressive demarcation is placed between science and spirituality. And it's almost the world in which we try to kind of juxtapose them and somehow create some kind of opposition between them. But actually, what I say is that science and spirituality just function in different domains. Science teaches us how to do things better. The spirituality teaches us to do better things. Science can work on the how and the what, but spirituality works on the why. Science is about products and processes, but spirituality is about philosophy. Science can improve things, but spirituality improves people. Science answers the questions, but spirituality questions the questions. And so, one scientist, he said, science and spirituality are opposed in the sense that my thumb and my forefinger are opposed. That opposition allows me to grasp things. And so what you'll actually find if you look at the history of science is that some of the most eminent and early scientists, they were actually grounded in spirituality and theology. One famous scientist says, all I'm doing by all my research is finding out how God did his work. And so there can be a synthesis between science and spirituality. And what we'll find is that science often corroborates what is established through spirituality. And in the same way, spirituality can give meaning and ethics and greater depth to scientific endeavors. And in that way, they can actually nourish each other instead of placing them in opposition.
Mm. Wow. I really like that point about how we can the early scientists were all religionists. That was amazing. Now, in terms of Hinduism, I've always wondered, you know, that we have so many different types of gods, demigods, godmen, you know, godwomen, you know. So it's, why do Hindus approach divinity through so many different forms? Isn't it, wouldn't an all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving God make it simple for the little, small, insignificant souls to approach him? Why is it like that there's so many different ways to approach him?
Yeah, Hinduism is an incredibly complex theological system, and that complexity actually makes for its beauty. I'll explain why. Hinduism is complex for two reasons. Number one, because the absolute truth is complex. And number two, because people are complex. Let's start with this one. When people approach a religion, people have different motivations. Some people come to religion with a grossly materialistic objective. Some people come to religion with a kind of mixed objective of material and a little bit of spiritual. Some people come with a predominantly spiritual objective but still have some material desires. And some come with a very, very pure spiritual aspiration. And so what the theological system of Hinduism does is it gives different entry points. It's what we call multi-level spirituality. And so whatever one desires, whatever one seeks, whatever aspirations are deep within one's heart, what the theological system does is it gives an opportunity for that person to begin their spiritual journey where they are. They say in teaching, the golden rule is, if you want to take someone somewhere, first you have to meet them where they are. And so the idea of the multi-level spirituality is to give an entrance point to every single person who has a multifarious desires. And from there, what the theological system then does is gradually takes them to higher and higher and more pure forms of spirituality. And so there are different gods, there are different types of worship, there are different types of what we call sadhana or spiritual daily habits. And all of these things are tailor-made for people who are looking for different things, but they're all aimed at spiritual elevation towards purity. Mm.
Thank you for that. You were talking about sadhana. I'll share something about my family. Is every morning when I used to wake up in the morning on weekends or Saturdays, I used to want to sleep in, and my parents would wake me up and ring this bell, and like, and it's just like, it was so annoying, you know. I just wanted to like watch SpongeBob or something like that, and I'm like, and then I go in front of like the little prayer room or duty room. I didn't really know what was going on. It's like, Everybody seems to be on there. I had a picture of my grandparents on there. You know, like, it's so many different forms. And why do we do this kind of ceremony of making forms of divinity made of marble, made of wood, and we call them deities? Why do we do this? Isn't it kind of like primitive and superstitious? Like, for example, we have a deity on the hood of my car, on the dashboard. You know, so isn't it kind of like primitive to kind of have these deities or things like that?
Yeah. See, God is everything. For God to be God, He has to be everything within your conception and everything beyond your conception. For God to be God, He has to have everything that you have and more. The moment we have something that God doesn't, or the moment we say God can't be like this, then we place a limitation. And so according to the theology of Sanatan Dharma, God is impersonal, He's an energy. God is simultaneously localized within everyone's heart, and God is simultaneously a person. All three of those identities can be and are accepted by God. And in the same way, when that personal divinity wants to descend to this world in order to enter into a transcendental exchange of love, then that supreme divinity comes in the form of material elements, wood, marble, stone, and so on. And those, although seemingly material, and although seemingly just dead matter, have the ability to be spiritualized by divine infusion. And really what it requires is one to upgrade their consciousness. For example, if I have a book here, if you don't know how to read, if you don't know spelling and you don't know grammar, then when I give you that book, all you'll see it as is paper. You'll just see it in a very material way, because that's how much you're able to grasp. But if you know language, if you know how to read, if you're literate, then when I give you that book, it can inspire you, it can touch you, it can change your life, it can reduce you to tears, it can make you laugh out in joy, it can energize and uplift and elevate your life. It's the same book, but because you've refined your vision and you've upgraded your consciousness, you're able to interact with it in a very different way. And so in the same way, people may say deities are just idols, they're marble, they're dead, they're kind of just, they're dolls. But when one approaches with a mood of devotion and with purified consciousness, then one can actually experience a very, very real divine reciprocation.
I was just thinking that one thing that did turn me off about Hinduism when I was growing up was this sense of all the rules and the regulations behind it. Like, couldn't we do like the bell ceremony at like 9 in the morning? when I've had my morning like wake up routine, and that, why does it have to be at like such an inconvenient time, like 6 or 6:30, you know? So why do we have so many rules and regulations? Isn't it, if it's all about expressing love with divinity, can we just do it from the heart whenever we need to? And when we don't want to, then, you know, just leave it.
Yeah. Yes. So this is a very good question. So what I want to share with you is that following rules, following a process, is actually one of the ways in which we awaken the deepest expression of our heart. I'll give you an example. Say you wanted to sit down in front of a piano and you wanted to express your heart, but you never took the time to learn notes. You never took the time to learn chords. Then you may sit in front of that piano, but because you never went through that regime of learning, you'd be very, very limited in your ability to express yourself. Or say, for example, I gave you a piece of paper and a pen, and you wanted to express your heart through beautiful poetry, but you never learned grammar, you never learned spelling, you never learned vocabulary. how much would you really be able to express? So the idea is that in spiritual practice, there's something called sadhana. And sadhana means a regulated practice. And to some extent, it's done out of duty. But what happens is that sadhana has the potentiality of what we call bhav. And bhav means a natural, spontaneous, emotional feeling. So the idea of the practice is that in the beginning, although they may seem ritualistic or mechanical or very regulated, what they're basically doing is awakening our spontaneity and empowering us with the ability to express our heart. And so following rules and expressing freedom are actually very much interconnected. I could give you another example. If you say, I want to be free, I'm not going to stop at any traffic lights anymore. And you go and jump a red, you know, a traffic light, then there's a very good chance, boom, you're going to get hit. And then once you're hit and your car is immobilized on the road, well, so much for your freedom. And so there's a sense in which following rules also awakens up an opportunity to discover a higher dimensional type of freedom and expression.
Convincing me here. I was hard not to crack, but I'm just... I read a little bit of the Gita, you know, it's a pretty interesting book. And I think you've written a few books about the Gita. If my understanding is correct, you know, like we kind of incorporate everybody's contribution. Like if you're kind of hardworking, you're known as a karma yogi. And if you're a little bit smarter, then if you go to Princeton, you're known as a jnana yogi. If you're a little bit more sentimental, then you're kind of like a more bhakti yogi, like a little emotional type. But is that kind of like the understanding that am I getting it right?
Yeah, so the word yoga, contrary to popular belief, is more than just a physical or kind of an emotional kind of exercise. Yoga is a process which connects us to divinity. And so within the Vedic tradition, there are different practices of yoga. Karma yoga is very much using one's physical and active capacity to connect that to divinity. Jnana yoga is very much about engaging one's intellect and through intellectual exercise trying to understand that absolute truth. And then bhakti yoga is very much about the heart and awakening that heart and connecting through love and devotion. These paths are in some sense independent, in another sense interrelated, because elements of every path are required within one path to make it effective. However, what Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita is that there is also a hierarchy in terms of our deepest aspiration. If I asked you, what for you, if you could choose one of these three, is most important? Option A, success. Option B, knowledge. Or option C, love.
Everything. I'm inclined to knowledge because I'm a class of Prince of 20 units. But you learn how to do the other things also. Maybe.
Okay.
Knowledge.
My proposition to you is that if you have success and knowledge, but you don't have love, you will find your life to be very empty. And the other way around, if you do have love, genuine love, and you maybe lack on knowledge or success, you still feel like you're living the life you want to live. What the ancient scriptures actually explain is that our highest and our deepest aspiration is to love and to be love. And therefore, all of the yoga processes, whether it be karma yoga, jnana yoga, although they all give divine connection, they're all culminating to the point where one can actually reawaken divine and true love, because that's the highest aspiration. And if you don't believe me, just go and listen to all the songs that people are singing. They're generally not singing about achieving the best job they want to. Generally not singing about the great grade they got in their exam. But they're generally singing about, you know, last Christmas, I gave you my heart. The very next day, blew it away. Generally, it's about love. And often, frustrated love. So the highest aspiration is love. Therefore, in a beautiful verse in the sixth chapter, Krishna says, Yoginam api sarvesham madgaten antaratmana shraddhavan bhajate yomam same yuktatamo mataha. Krishna says there is a yukta, there is a yogi who is a yukta, connected. But this particular yogi is yuktatama. He's the most connected. He's the uttam. He's the highest of connected yogis. And who is that yogi? The yogi that has love, has awakened love. But yes, all of these yoga practices are there, but the ultimate aspiration is bhakti.
Thank you so much. I just wanted to wrap up with like two more questions. And I wanted to get back to the main topic, which was dharma. And once you've found your dharma, don't you sometimes find they conflict? Because it seems like as a Hindu American, we have many dharmas that we have, like many shoes to fill. Like we have the traditional dharma, which is like what our fathers and our grandfather did. But then we have what are we supposed to do in modern life? We're not living in 1800s Tamil Nadu anymore. We're living in Princeton, New Jersey, you know? So we can't really... Don't they conflict sometimes, dharma? Like there's individual dharma, then there's societal dharma. What do you do when you have conflicting dharmas?
Thank you so much. So there are two points here. One is the variety of dharmas that you have and how to fulfill all of them. And the other question you're asking is about how to take ancient dharmic principles and live them in today's day and age. So let's deal with those separately. The first one is, yes, we do have many dharmas. Broadly speaking, we can say we have two dharmas. Sanatan dharma means your deep spiritual purpose, which is that you're a spiritual being and you're on your way to the transcendent realm. And that is a deep purpose you have in your life to nourish that journey. And the other dharma you have is Svadharma, which means the dharma you have in this body, in this psycho-physical makeup that you've been given. And within that Svadharma, we can say there are different dharmas. You may have a certain occupational dharma, a family dharma, a societal dharma, a dharma as a husband, as a wife, as a child, as a parent, an emergency dharma according to changing situations. So Svadharma encompasses all of these. And then you have Sanatan Dharma. So how do you balance all of these? With great difficulty. I would say they're not conflicting, but they just need to be balanced. And therefore, when one looks at all of the roles that they play, Krishna recommends that many of these roles can be integrated so that when you are doing your duty as a parent, you're simultaneously contributing to your spiritual journey. Or when you're looking after your family, then you do it in such a way that it also fulfills your duties to society as well. So there is a way to integrate dharmas so that you can fulfill many things at once. And at different times in our life, we may put emphasis on different aspects of dharma as well. And so dharma can be balanced. And yes, the other point you made is that dharma has to be translated. So say, for example, I'm a sannyasi, but I don't live like a sannyasi lived 500 years ago. For one, I have an iPhone 13. Simple living, high thinking. So we take the principles in Dharma. In Vedic culture, there are principles and then there are details. And so the principles stand true in all times, places and circumstances. But how those principles are then applied in the current situation will vary. and therefore there requires a certain amount of translation. And so the principle of a sannyasi is to keep traveling, to keep moving. And the way they would do it years ago is they would sleep under one tree for not more than 3 nights, and then they would move to the next tree. In 2024, is one airport every 3 days. And it's not sleeping under trees, but it's moving from maybe temple to temple. So the principle remains that a sannyasi travels, that the rolling stone gathers no moss. But how they do that, so that will vary. There is a concept of how, for example, females and what their role in society is. So there are principles which are given, but how then the females will apply that in today's context may differ. And so that requires a certain translation.
Mm. Thank you so much. When I moved to college, when I moved into my dorm, there was no bells in the morning, you know, and
I really have an issue with that.
There was the bell ceremony wasn't there. I didn't have my mom pushing me like, okay, come and see the deities or to pay your visits or anything like that. And I had to really choose whether I want to continue this kind of path, or do I just wanted to become my own person. And I did a cost benefit analysis, and I saw that this path in my life had more pros than cons, and now I do my own bell ceremony. But I was just thinking, do you have any advice in a world of social pressure and a lot of peer pressure, how to lead a dharmic centered lifestyle in a modern college campus setting?
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, the first thing I would say is to echo something Einstein said, which is never stop questioning. Curiosity has its own reason for existing. And I think to explore, to understand, to question, to challenge, to really get to the bottom of what we're following, and to ask ourselves, does this resonate with me? Does it make sense to me? Is it something that's relevant and useful to me? I think the moment we go on that journey of actually understanding and exploring why we're doing what we're doing, we go on a very positive trajectory. And then I think as a student, it's a great time in life. It's a time when not only is your dharma to do academically very well, but I think it's a time in your life where your dharma is to ask yourselves the big questions. What is my why? What does success look like for me 10 years from now? What values and principles do I want to live by that I'll never compromise in any situation? Where do I want to live? What kind of job do I want to do? These are questions which a student can ask now, and those are life questions. So I think university is a beautiful time. It's a time when you can academically strive, but it's time when you can also orientate life and find a conscious direction for your journey. And so I think that is the dharma of a student, to strive on both of those levels.